Welcome to the CME IBD podcast series, Enteral Nutrition as Primary Therapy for Crohn's Disease, Making It Happen for Pediatric Patients. This topic is covered over 5 podcast episodes. This 3rd episode focuses on a modified approach to the use of enteral nutrition for induction of remission in pediatric Crohn's disease at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Our series is sponsored by the NASPGHAN Foundation for Children's Digestive Health and Nutrition, along with the North American Society for Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition. A special thank you to Abbott Nutrition for providing support for this program. I'm Dr. Tony Otley, moderator and chair of the program, and professor of pediatrics at the IWK Health Center in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. Our faculty today are Dr. Robert Baldassano, professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, and director of the Center for Pediatric Inflammatory Bowel Disease at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Also, Sarah Weston, an outpatient clinical dietitian in gastroenterology and intestinal rehabilitation program, and a clinical dietitian at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And Merrill Reichbach, a social worker in the Division of Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Sarah, I think this is a good time to bring you in. So we've heard how the one approach, which is to use the exclusive enteral nutrition, but at CHOP, you guys have a different take on it. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Basically, at CHOP, our protocol is to do 8 to 12 weeks, sort of physician-dependent, and we give 80 to 90% of estimated calorie needs, typically from tube feeds. We give these overnight, usually over 8 to 12 hours, and since we're using such a large volume and a little bit of time, we tend to use a 1.5 kcal per ml hydroxylate formula, whey protein for better gastric emptying. Children are allowed to eat during the day. There's no restriction on the types of foods. Previously, we haven't necessarily restricted the oral calories as long as they were getting a certain portion of total calories from estimated needs from the tube feeds. We weren't really restricting the oral intake. Most of the kids tend to self-restrict given that they are very full from the tube feeds over the day. Over the past year or so, as the program has grown and we're seeing many more of these children, we're starting to move towards the more standard recommendations, including calorie limits, but nothing's finalized quite yet. Occasionally, kids come to our center who want to drink the formula. We have no, if they want to drink the formula, that's absolutely fine. In that case, typically, if you're going to drink it, I don't recommend a hydroxylate, and we recommend an intact protein 1.5 kcal per ml formula, usually a commercially available one, as oftentimes this option isn't covered by insurance as the formulas that go through the tube typically are. I don't have as much experience with this in terms of most of my kids are more tube fed, but it is something that I do see from time to time and seems to be just as effective.
Yeah, Sarah, I think it's so interesting because you talk to practitioners in the United Kingdom and oral is the way they go. My sense is that they tend to use a shorter duration, so often it's more 6 week of exclusive enteral nutrition, because I would think taste fatigue would come in there, and that if you're drinking the same stuff day in, day out, certainly to go 12 weeks like we do, I would think that would be a huge factor in people dropping out or going to eat. Now, again, that's for us where we have the exclusive enteral nutrition. Maybe that's an issue.
I agree, Tony. I would say that I think it's an option for a very highly motivated parent/family. I think it's an option, but I would say a lot of those kids do wind up reverting to a tube or discontinuing therapy because for taste fatigue, for many other reasons. For a lot of the kids, they feel it's actually rather inconvenient to take this stuff to school and to have to drink something that's different than what everyone else is drinking, whereas the tube still kind of lets them do that without having to eat or drink something.
What I have noticed with a good number of my patients that have tried drinking and then go to the tube, they say that the tube has really decreased the stress in the household. Now, prior to using the tube, and these kids already, many of them have eating issues going in because of their disease, that the family is continuously telling them they have to eat. Then when they switch to enteral nutrition PO, then they have to drink, and there's continuous fighting going on in the home. And they say once they switch over to the tube, life just becomes so much better for everyone. Kids aren't getting yelled at all the time. Parents aren't yelling all the time. And the family also feels somewhat relaxed about whatever they do during the day because they know at night they're going to get their caloric needs. So actually, I think it takes stress out of the household when you do a two-feed strategy compared to a PO strategy.
And I think the other issue with the PO versus the tube, when it comes to maintenance therapy, you know, without, if you're having to do the PO route, I'm not sure how practically that would work for maintenance. Certainly we've done it always where it's overnight that we do that and then not restricting things during the day when we go to the maintenance piece. So
the other concern I have is continuous, and this is an argument, I think, for your approach of 20 hours a day, continuous versus bolus, that when you, especially initially when you have significant amount of intestinal inflammation, how well are you absorbing your nutrients? And to bolus feed, you probably malabsorb, particularly carbohydrates, maybe your fats, but if you give it on a slow, continuous basis, you might improve absorption and nutrition. But better, even maybe more important than that, I'm sure there's different changes in the gut microbiome if you're malabsorbing. So I have many patients that will complain of having diarrhea when they either bolus or they take their feeds over a very short period of time. I have some boys or some kids that for some reason they try to get all their feeds in 4 hours and they pull their tube out and then they say they can sleep the rest of the night. They all have significant amount of diarrhea that day. While if I could stretch out their feeds over time, it seems like they tolerate the feed much better. So again, there might be changes to the gut microbiome if you bolus versus, you know, slow continuous feed.
Right. So let's get back to our scenario, that newly diagnosed Crohn's patient. So we've talked about...
Excuse me one thing, Tony. I guess I just wanted to bring up a little bit. We talked about the different strategies comparing the exclusive enteral approach, which is essentially 100% of feeds, versus the sort of more maybe unique or novel approach at CHOP of using 80 to 90% of the feeds. I do want to say, so nobody is misled out there listening to this this conversation, is, you know, we recently, in which Tony and I were participants, have done a large trial looking at enteral nutrition between the Canadian groups and the Americans and actually comparing to kids on anti-TNF therapies. And it does seem that more of this therapy you do, the better. And what I'm saying is it does seem that the Canadian kids doing 100% had a greater response rate or remission rate than the kids who did not do exclusive therapy. So our approach would be is we start with the 80 to 90% of enteral nutrition, but if a person is not responding appropriately, then our recommendations would be to go to exclusive feeds.
Okay, no, that's great. That's helpful. So, Bob, if we've now sort of we've made the decision, the family's decided they want to go on enteral nutrition. At CHOP, what's the next step? What do you do next to make that happen?
So at that point, I sort of take advantage of some of the resources that we have at CHOP. And so the next step would be typically if we give Sarah a call, nutrition, and that the family will get to meet her and we get an idea of what our caloric needs would be. And so then once they go to Sarah, I guess maybe we have to ask Sarah where she sends them sort of down the line in order to actually get the job done.
Sure. So we are very fortunate here that we have our Conley Center, which is our educational center here for families that was designed by families. And so they meet, the families go for a 3-hour education session where they learn how to put down the NG tube. They bring all of their own supplies. So they're using their pump, their NG tubes, and they learn how to facilitate using the therapy. And we get nothing but really good feedback about that approach. It's very nice to not have to do it in the office where it's not kind of tagged onto a visit. You know, it's a separate appointment. Sometimes the kids have a little anxiety about learning how to place the tube, and we have Child Life available to kind of help, you know, calm their fears, so to speak. And the orders are all kind of set up in between my appointment with them and Conley, and so they come with their own supplies and everything.
The one mistake I think I see when I see other individuals who don't have the resources try to implement this is they typically hospitalize the child to do the teaching and the tube feeding initially. And the nurses that are used or whatever nurses are to care for that patient that day, I think there is a real advantage that there's somebody who's really trained to place in these feeding tubes and not just somebody that knows how to put an NG tube in and that's the person that sort of teaches the family how to do it. It just seems like the outcome, just in my experience, but again, by seeing second opinions come into our center, has failed.
Well, I would say, Cynthia and I would totally agree with you that we've found exactly that. We have an outpatient area where the nurse who does that has done this all the time. And I always say that it has to be such a positive experience. There was one point where some people were doing, and you know, cleanouts have changed for scope, but there was one point where they were doing an NG to give the cleanout, and I always said like no, because I don't want them to associate, you know, right, hear the word NG and that big honking tube that was used to clean them out. Thank goodness we don't do that anymore. But it's so important that that initial experience is positive. And you're right that it can be done as an outpatient, and if you do it as an inpatient, it couldn't be any nurse that may not have that familiarity with doing that whole experience of, and I think what we found as well is to get the teen to learn to put the tube down themselves. It doesn't work for everybody. Not every teen's able to do it initially, but the tube feed process goes that much easier if from the get-go the teen puts the tube down themselves. Meryl, this just seems like a good time to bring you in because the physician, the dietitians, come up with this plan about starting the feeds. And it sounds like at CHOP, you've got the Connolly Center, so you've got some resources that other centers may not have access to. What's your role? How do you help make this process work?
Well, we're often called to problem solve, troubleshoot. We're able to come in, meet with the family, address any psychosocial stressors, which can be coming up when you're newly diagnosed with a chronic illness and then adjusting to a treatment regimen. A barrier that we often see here at CHOP can be financial. So we work with the families on how to advocate with their insurance companies and also connect them with agencies outside of insurance. One resource we use is OLEYfund, OLEY.org. It's a great resource online to support patients and families on enteral nutrition. They also have access to formula and supplies, which we always refer families to, especially when insurance is a barrier. And then another thing is just emotional support, whether it's the family adjusting to have to drop the tube, as you mentioned, the teen adjusting to that. At times we're able to connect families. We do, like other centers, the IBD Education Day, which is a great chance for parents and patients to meet other people so they can sort of normalize the experience, because oftentimes we see our patients, you know, they might be the only child in the classroom who has this tube, and it can be helpful for them to meet somebody else who's also gone through it. And just a lot of that emotional reinforcement, as Cynthia mentioned earlier, just being positive and providing that guidance and having a place for them to just ask all of these questions. I think sometimes families can be a little bit intimidated by all of the medical aspect, and so we're able to come in really as a non-medically trained person just to support the family, either be a liaison between them and the medical team, between them and maybe the school, extracurricular activities, any place that the family feels like they could use a little bit more support.
Great. Okay. So that's again, certainly having that anticipatory guidance. What are the things that we know other families have struggled with or things that are concerns, and dealing with those up front is very helpful. Meryl, Sarah, Cynthia, any other issues?
Did you want me to briefly touch on how we do maintenance at all?
Sure.
Okay, so for us, for maintenance therapy, since we start with already with doing overnight feeds, typically, depending on the child and their personal situation, I always say it's absolutely up to the physician, because I always get the question, but it's physician-driven. Once they demonstrate that they are in maintenance and doing well, remission and doing well, we typically start decreasing to 6 days a week and then eventually decreasing to 5 days a week. Some of my older kids, particularly ones who are in college, like to try to even reduce that further in times of days and are willing to do more volume on other days, and I think success rates, I think, are a little they're variable, I would say. And Bob can maybe speak a little bit more to that in terms of that. But that's typically how we do. We just typically reduce the amount of days that the child is on therapy.
Sure. All right. So it does seem like there's something, so I think, a little bit magical about the five.
Yes,
at least if people continue to do well. And then when we go less than that, I always am holding my breath a little bit, thinking that I don't really think this is enough, but I guess we'll see what happens if I have no other choice.
I've only had success when kids are willing to do more volume 4 days a week. So basically they're doing 5 days a week of feeds, but they're really doing it 4 days, if that makes sense. If you do more volume, that's the only way it's been successful for me with less than 5 days.
And yet another area where we need to do some more research to figure out what is that critical value, what's that critical amount or formula type. I think, you know, it's a type of therapy where we still have so many unanswered questions. Thanks for listening to this episode in the CME IBD podcast series. Please go to pedibd.org to access future episodes. I'm Tony Otley.